Welcome to the final edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I used to be Ron Elvey.
And I'm still Ken Rudin. And Ron, there are a lot of things
to talk about. Am I too pessimistic? Am I just being too dark about this? Maybe it isn't so bad.
Well, it is bad. We're talking about the situation with NPR. I don't mean to be
Are we self-fascinated here at this point? Should we not be talking about... But this is politics, and it's politics here in Washington.
And
in the country.
And it's on the front page of every newspaper in the country, so you know that people do care about this, and we care about this, too.
We do.
It was an embarrassing week. It was an infuriating week. And it's still an unsettling and upsetting week, and I think that the listener expects us to discuss some part of the podcast. Why not open with it?
I think that's a good idea.
Well, when that video came out of Ron Schiller, who was then the head of corporate
fundraising. Not a journalist, not a person who's ever been a journalist.
No, but perception is reality in this country and certainly in this city.
And he's called an NPR executive,
exactly.
And that's that.
An NPR executive is seen on tape disparaging the Tea Party and disparaging Republicans and conservatives.
In ways that you and I would absolutely disavow.
We don't think that way. I mean,
exactly.
We love the system. We love the process. We love politics. And we're not, I mean, I've known you for months now, Ron. We're not ideologues. This is a very uncomfortable and bizarre position for us to be in.
In this political climate, at just the moment when the federal government is 1 week away from another potential shutdown over this budget impasse, there are those who have seen fit to target not just NPR, but all public broadcasting, not because it's a big part of the budget, because we're talking
about little m's, it's millions.
Right. And by the way, I'm all for budget balancing efforts. I don't think we should exempt Medicare or Medicaid. Everything has to be looked at. Revenues have to be looked at, defense spending.
Sure.
And that certainly includes the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm all for including them in some kind of a stringent look at how the federal government spends money.
And this is part of the larger discussion about how to deal with budget priorities. And obviously, what we saw in Washington this week in the Senate, that neither side seems to have the upper hand, and basically we're back to a stalemate.
Well, and it's true. And there is probably a group of people. We've talked about this Gang of Six that came out of the president's own budget-cutting and deficit-reducing commission last winter, led by Al Simpson and Erskine Bowles. And they came out with some recommendations. And this group that is meeting, three Democrats, three Republicans, came out of the participants in that group. It's a little larger now. And they are trying to reach some kind of common ground. And we should say...
You don't say the word compromise, by the way. It's common ground.
Common ground.
You can't say compromise.
And, by the way, the Simpson-Bowles Commission actually included a zeroing out of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
We're talking about, this is maybe a little aside here, but everybody's saying, well, you know, it's we were ambushed by this prank, by this video. Well, look, that's the way politics is played. We saw Scott Walker ambushed by the left not too long ago, the governor of Wisconsin, when he thought he was on the phone with David Koch about fundraising, about money and things like that.
And if Ron Schiller had conducted himself nearly as well as Scott Walker had on that phone call,
Ron Schiller would still be governor
of
Wisconsin today. Exactly. Okay, but we still have two sides offering budget proposals that went nowhere, couldn't even get 50%. You had the Republicans in the Senate.
I thought it was interesting that
50 votes, yeah.
50 votes.
You had the Republicans basically taking the House language for $61 billion in cuts.
Current year.
Which
means between September 30th.
Right,
that is right.
That got 44, 46 votes.
Not even
votes.
All the Republicans voted for
it. No, because there were three or so Republicans who felt it wasn't enough.
It should be bigger. Yeah, that's right. Well, that's the cheapest vote in the world. Somebody comes down and says, here's a huge draconian cut most of the country thinks is too deep. And you say,
More. That was the message
enough.
Of November 2nd.
Not deep enough.
Okay, and on the Democratic side, they offered a paltry compared to $61 billion, but also, I think for most people, six-some-odd billion dollars in cuts. And 10 Democrats said, wait a second, you know, let's get a reality check here. That's not going to fly either. It's certainly not the message of what's in this country, what needs to be cut. So, obviously, if it's going to happen, look, we're going to probably have a short-term, right, a CR?
Well, there's another question because the current CR runs out on March 18th, and then we have to determine whether they want to do another two-week CR or another four or whatever. And the Republicans are insisting that for each one of these additional CRs, we cut a couple of billion dollars a week.
Right.
So it's $4 billion for 2 weeks. It's $6 billion for 3 weeks. And I won't try to push the math any further than that. But it's essentially...
reaching that $61 billion
exactly.
mark.
Exactly. At some point or another, it's death by a thousand cuts.
Now, everybody's saying, where is President Obama in all this? Joe Biden, who basically had been running the budget talks, now he's out in...
Moscow. And so who knows? Maybe William Daley, the new chief of staff at the White House, is really running the negotiations for them. One hears that. But this White House right now is in a mode. It's so unusual for the Obama administration especially, of stepping back from a whole raft of controversies. They don't want to be visible in the budget negotiations. They want to see where Congress comes out before they engage. They don't want to be terribly visible with respect to the Libya conflict. Right. They've got our ambassador to NATO talking about a no-fly zone that we would obviously have to be the enforcer
of. There are different messages
of.
Regarding Libya coming out of the White House almost every day.
Almost
right?
every day. I think that's deliberate. It may be disorganization, but my guess is they don't want to have a clear signal that Gaddafi can play off of. This is essentially the same thing they did with Egypt, the same thing they've done with several other countries with this unrest and uprising recently. They don't want it to be about the United States. They don't want us to be a player in it. And I should add, they have not really taken much of a strong position at all with regard to the huge controversy going on in Wisconsin and other states where governors are not only trying to balance the budget through cutting and not revenue increases, but where governors are using this moment
right.
as an opportunity to bust the public employee unions.
Before we go to Wisconsin, Joe, we saw Joe Manchin step up, and the Democrat from West Virginia who's up for re-election.
In 2012.
Who says that, look, Obama's not leading at all.
This is the same guy who ran against Obama as a Democrat in 2010.
Right, that's not a surprise, but it gives Republicans some cover. Says, look, your own Democrats don't know where the president is.
All right, but in Wisconsin, you've got a situation where people are really getting focused. I mean, the people of Wisconsin have had this three-week-long crisis in which the Democratic senators literally left the state to try to keep the budget from passing because the budget had not only a lot of controversy, but also this busting of the collective bargaining rights of public employees.
Right.
And then the Republicans finally figured out, and one wonders why they didn't do this 20 days ago,
yeah.
they said, hey, what if we stripped out all the budget provisions, which are what require a
certain quorum,
the
20-vote quorum
in the
right?
Senate, and just pass this as a regular freestanding bill, then the rules are different, and the Democrats don't need to be here, and we can do it on our own. And one thinks maybe they could have done that a couple of weeks ago.
But they did it on Wednesday.
And they did it this week with the effect that if the House follows suit, which we fully expect and will have happened by the time this podcast reaches the
right,
listener.
It's scheduled vote for Thursday.
And Scott Walker will then sign it. That is much a done deal in Wisconsin as, say, the Obama health care law is a done deal.
Now, the Democrats are crying foul, but at the same time, you have Republicans saying, wait a second, you fled the state for 3 weeks. I mean, you know, it's not that we did something underhanded. We wanted you to be part of these negotiations. Of course, they had no chance of succeeding the Democrats, and that's
right. Extreme tactics right. on the Democrats' right. part, followed by extreme tactics on the Republicans' part.
And that's why you're seeing recalls among members from both parties. Wisconsin is known for a very kind of a lax recall state. There's always, they tried to recall Senators Cole and Feingold a bunch of years ago. I remember governors in the past, in the decades past, there was always a recall motion. But now there's a serious effort for the Democratic part to recall some tenuously elected Republicans in the
because
state.
Because even in 2010, not every Republican won in a landslide.
Oh, no, not at all. But as a matter of fact, they took Democratic seats by a scant margin in some of these districts, and those ones would be obviously more susceptible, I would think, to a recall. But then the Republicans are also talking about, wait, these guys fled the state. They were elected to do the job. They fled to Illinois or wherever they fled to. They
clearly
should be recalled
as well.
Clearly
an unpopular kind of tactic. Yeah. That's right. Only the hardcore is going to say, oh, great, that's brilliant. Let's send you guys over to Chicago for a few weeks. It's not sustainable. If you are the minority party, at some point or another, you have to show up and take a licking. Now, this is such an extreme instance, and this legislation is a reversal of a 52-year-old law in
especially
Wisconsin,
in a state that is so known for
which
union rights.
Gaylord yeah. Nelson was the governor before he was senator, and he signed into law the first and most sweeping collective bargaining rights bill for public employees in the country, as I understand it, in 1959. And for this to be the place where they pull it back is highly symbolic. Of course, it is delightful to all conservatives throughout the country who have felt that collective bargaining for public employees was a disaster.
I'm just curious, do you know who succeeded Gaylord Nelson as governor of Wisconsin?
Yes, I do. John Reynolds.
That is correct.
Well, okay. But full disclosure, I was a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal in the 1970s and 1980s and have many, many fond memories in Wisconsin. And it really is heartbreaking to watch the degree of divisiveness and partisanship, which have not always characterized Wisconsin.
I mean,
People have a lot of misimpressions about the state. Some people think of it as the state of Joe McCarthy, and others think that it's the most progressive state in the union. It's both. And it has always been both, but people have managed to get along, and there have always been ways that the politicians themselves and the people, the more general electorate of Wisconsin, has ultimately liked to like each other in the end. And it is extraordinarily sad to see that being so strained.
There are two questions that these actions lead to, and the questions are, one, is it constitutional, and whether the Republican effort to strip out the language about collective bargaining, whether that would survive court challenge, and two, the Republican governors like Mitch Daniels, like Chris Christie, like John Kasich, are looking at the Wisconsin model to see if, politically at least, it's saleable, and whether it's saleable in their own states. Now, I've seen no indication that these governors want to go as far as Scott Walker has in Wisconsin, but obviously you see Chris Christie, you know, pounding on the chest saying the public employees are really just, you know, arrogant and they need to be taken down a notch, and you wonder how much of this is really budgetary and how much of it is ideological.
Excuse me if this is a bit of a cheesy segue, but if we could go just a little west of Wisconsin across the Mississippi River into the state of Iowa, we would find there, of course, many, many Republican candidates campaigning full-time for the nomination of this resurgent Republican Party to be the next president of the United States. Isn't that the case, Ken Rudin?
Well, no, but we see a glimmer of life in the last couple of days, and we saw on Monday the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition event where five alleged candidates, although two of them have...
Oh, they were the big candidates, though, Romney Palin.
No, I wasn't there, no. No, Huckabee wasn't there, no.
Mike Huckabee?
No, Daniels, no.
Well, what about John Huntsman Jr. from Utah? Surely he was there.
Don't call me Shirley, and he was not there. But the ones who were there were Herman Cain.
Herman Cain!
Right, because he's very able. There's also Buddy Romer, who I understand was the star of the event, very folksy.
He was very folksy.
But very folksy.
And he went after PACs. He went after political action committees.
Yeah, which, you know, something he's talked about,
the
special interest in the Republican Party and how he's just going to take a $100 contribution. That was
if he can find anybody, he'll give him $100.
Well, the issue was, I mean, we talked about special money in the 2010 elections, which overwhelmingly benefited Republicans. I saw no Republicans saying that this is abhorrent and should disappear.
But it's a populist argument that always works to say we're not going to let a lot of special interest money in. It works at the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition.
Yes, but if Barack Obama is going to spend $1 billion on his campaign in 2012 against Buddy Romer's $250 total.
Well, you're assuming two and a half people are willing to give him.
Well, but the listener, and yeah.
Moving on, who else was there?
Well,
were there any former House speakers there?
There was a guy named Newt Gingrich who we all thought was going to launch into an exploratory committee, but actually all he's doing is testing the waters.
I see. Well, that's certainly a campaign to keep an eye on. Well, how about Tim Pawlenty from neighboring Minnesota?
And Tim Pawlenty,
they like Minnesotans in Iowa.
But he is speaking...
Only if they're running for president in the caucuses. Otherwise, Iowans don't like Minnesotans.
Yeah, I don't think they really purposed it well in Iowa, no.
But Mondale did, though.
But here's the thing, though. Cognizant of what happened in 2008 with Mike Huckabee and, of course, Pat Robertson's strong showing in 1988, Tim Pawlenty has gone from what I thought was a moderate... secular Republican to this evangelical speaking Republican.
Now, in fairness, he has always had a religious background. He's always had a church background. It's not as though he's a deathbed convert or something, but he is emphasizing a different part of
indeed.
His palate.
Yeah.
And, well, he's no longer running in the blue state of Minnesota. He is now running in the very conservative, social conservative environment of the Iowa caucuses, the Republican Party is a very conservative venue indeed.
And Rick Santorum was there too, who also has very strong ties to the pro-life religious conservative.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Nobody has better anti-abortion credentials than Rick Santorum.
Now, where's Ron Paul? Ron Paul wasn't there, was he?
Ron Paul was not there.
He was in Iowa, but he was not at the...
He didn't go to the Faith and Freedom Coalition event.
Because he is an economic conservative.
He's running as a libertarian.
Yes.
And let's face it, his message just isn't going to play at that particular forum. So, come on. Tim Pawlenty is the only one who's a frontliner in that group.
I do not believe
that any of the others is going to be a serious contender, even in the Iowa caucuses, let alone thereafter. But if there are not as many Republicans getting into Iowa as we expected, we are seeing quite a few people trying to get out of the United States Senate.
Well, the last case, and it's probably good news for the Republicans, it's a Republican incumbent, two-term Republican John Ensign in Nevada.
And he shared with us the insight this week that sin has consequences.
It does. It does. And that's it for this week.
Would you care to elaborate on that, Rabbi Rudin?
I'm still employed at NPR, so obviously sin does not have consequences.
Well, not in every case immediately.
But John Ensign, having confessed to an affair with the wife of his top aide and former campaign worker.
Well, at least he kept it, you know, close to home.
Right. He's always been pro-family, so there he is.
Why not?
Extremely.
Yours.
Okay, so with John Ensign gone, Republicans look like it's going to rally behind either Dean Heller, a member of Congress who represents the entire state except where there are people, which is like Las Vegas
and Henderson.
And Henderson,
right,
exactly. Right. But Sharon Angle's name has been mentioned, too. She either will run for the Senate.
No, look, I mean, they just got to give that nomination to Sharon Angle, don't you think?
No.
Because here is the person who managed to run against the least popular senator in the United States. And lose.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So, Dean Heller.
But she once ran for Congress against Dean Heller, lost the primary narrowly, so if Heller's running for the Senate, she might run for Heller's House seat.
Okay, that would make more sense. So, by my count, that is eight United States senators right. who have said they just as soon not be back. And that includes now three Republicans, one independent, Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, and four Democrats.
That's correct.
All right. We also saw someone wanting to get into the United States Senate this week in the state of New Mexico, where Jeff Bingaman is retiring. We saw a Republican getting in early.
Well, this is Heather Wilson, the former member of Congress who gave up her seat in 2008 to succeed Pete Domenici. Everybody says this is the argument.
Which, of course, she did not do.
No, because she lost the primary to a more conservative candidate, Steve Pearce, and that's the argument against Heather Wilson. Strong in the general election, but weak among conservative voters in a Republican primary. And John Sanchez, the lieutenant governor, all but threw his hat in the ring as well. I still suspect that Heather Wilson, she's a favorite among moderates. The media like her a lot. But I still suspect that Heather Wilson does not survive a Republican primary.
Want to talk about one thing before we leave this podcast this week. We have to tip our hat, both of us, throughout our careers, and I really mean all the way back to college, were readers and admirers of one American political reporter, maybe more than all others, David Broder of The Washington Post.
I feel that very, very strongly. Every time I was in his presence, and actually I once had the privilege of sitting on an entire plane flight with him for several hours, and we talked about everything. This guy was everything I think of what a political journalist should be. Not bombastic, not showy, not obnoxious. This guy was a solid journalist. He did throw in more opinions in his later years.
I think he was forced to by people who wanted him to seem hipper. It was never David Broder's
thing.
It was never his thing. He was encyclopedic in what he knew. He was insanely even-handed in what he told.
He cared about what he wrote about. He cared about voters. And he was
knocked on more doors than most politicians have ever thought of knocking on and constantly stayed in touch with the people.
Died this week at the age of 81, sorely missed.
And highly honored. Thank you, David. That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week.
I hope so.
For It's All Politics from NPR.
Oh, ooby-doo, I want to be like you. Hop-dee-ooby-doo, I want to walk like you. Chip-talk like you. Chip-choo, weepy-dee-be-doo. You see it's true. Shoo-bitty-doo, an ape like me.